There's no way we're going to be able to accomplish what we're setting out to do today. Let me just say that. I want to make sure that we don't set ourselves up for ultimate frustration, just a little bit of it. We have been speaking for at least one session, and as a community for a long time, on the question of dynamic Judaism. We are an example of dynamic Judaism. We're not the only place that it exists. Last time we got together, we spoke about primarily texts from Deuteronomy, focusing on the mandate to a living Jewish community, though in their time it was an Israelite community, the mandate to explore Torah and not violate its integrity. And the texts touch on something called Bal Tosif, which is the commandment not to add to Torah. Which, of course, is quite strange, because how can you not add to Torah? If the Torah presumes that the world is going to continue growing, how can you only live with the rules that you inherit? The word electricity is an easy example. How about egalitarianism? Well, the Torah might have a response depending on who's interpreting it, which is why one of the other texts in Deuteronomy is important to bring in as well. It says, when you have a question that is too baffling and doesn't have an answer already prescribed, go to the shoftim, the judges, in your time. And an example of that is in the book of Numbers, Bamidbar, where the daughters of Tzlofchad, who are the only children to the man named Tzlofchad, have a question when their father dies. Because the laws of inheritance until that point only give rights to the property of the father to sons. And if there are no sons, it goes to someone else, but not to daughters. And they say, this is not just. What do we do? Moses has no answer, which is incredibly important in our conversation. And Moses turns directly to God, saying, what do I do? And God said, the daughters of Tzlofchad are right. The reason why it's important to start with that part of the conversation is, Bal Tosif, as a Jewish concept, is part of Jewish tradition. Don't add to Torah. Bal Tigra is the opposite. Don't detract from Torah. Within those parameters, the question is, what do you do? Moses models one potential response, which is what we're going to sort of explore today. Moses says, I don't know what the answer is based on what I know. Let me turn to the universe. Let me ask God what to do. One of the questions that we have in our modern Jewish world is, when a new question comes up, who has the authority to suggest a response, and what authority does that response carry in our own daily choices? Egalitarianism is a good concept of that, because I could point to the daughters of Tzlofchad being legitimated as question askers, and then the response says, yes, they're right. There are early hints of that. Sarah saying to Avram, send out Hagar. It's not that I'm saying that's a moral imperative, that was a moral decision, but her authority is substantiated by God, who says to Abram, listen to your wife. So there are hints of egalitarianism, but does that lead to a woman rabbi? Depending on which denomination, we'll get to what that means in a moment, depending on which denomination's framework we are using as our entry point, we will have different responses, because there are those who would invoke the concept of Bal Tosif. Don't add to the system. Don't detract from the system. So when the question is, what's the woman's place in Judaism? The answer is, we already know what the woman's place in Judaism is. The woman's place in Judaism is a specific type of participation, but not ritual leadership. Right? That is, at least at the moment, the prevalent Orthodox response to the question. It is an authentic response to the question based on the very concept of Bal Tosif. Who has the authority to make a change? Is today's Judaism lived at Netivot Shalom recognizable by Rabbi Akiva in first century early rabbinic Judaism? The answer is no. But we do teach in his voice. But what's also important is that orthodoxy isn't recognizable to Rabbi Akiva either. So when we talk about the different varieties of Judaism, it's very important not to be triumphalist. We are not, no matter what we are, the exclusive incarnation of Judaism that has a legitimate root. So then the question is, what are denominations? Are they about ultimate truth? Are they absolutes? Is conservative Judaism, Reform Judaism, Orthodox Judaism, Renewal Judaism, Reconstructionist Judaism, Humanist Judaism, Israeli versions of all of those things, are any of them right? And if they're not right with a capital R, meaning truth with a capital T, if they are not, what claim do they have on our allegiances? Why would we listen? Why would any rabbi speak with any authority in any community if they weren't speaking the truth? These are important questions. So what we have in front of us is an opportunity to have a very fruitful conversation, but we should not see it as the end of the conversation. I know I say that all the time, but it's very important that if we invoke the term dynamic Judaism, it can't end in one conversation, no matter how good the conversation is. That's why a lifelong struggle with Judaism is intentional. It's an ideal. It's hard. It's also really fun. So here's what we're not going to do. We are not going to talk about the organizational structures of modern denominations. Like, you know, it's synagogue and the conservative movement, the rabbinical assembly, JTS, the Ziegler School, the Israeli parts, the Buenos Aires, Seminario Rabbinico. So those are some of the constellation of conservative Judaism, Masorti Judaism in the world. That's not our conversation. Because that's really important, but not as useful to the ideas that are supposed to be behind the institutions. But I will invoke one quote by Rabbi Yitz Greenberg, who's a modern Orthodox rabbi. He says, I don't care what kind of Jew you are, as long as you're a little bit ashamed. That's a good place to start. Because if we are so excited about the type of Jew we are, whatever that means, that we say, yeah, that's it, and everything else isn't, we're forgetting that we have our own stuff to work on. Everybody has baggage. Everybody. So I'm a proud conservative Jew. Always have been. I pray that I always will be, based on the conservative movement's ability to adapt to moral imperatives as they coalesce in our people's consciousness. But that's not the only kind of great Jew to be. We have to be able to say that if we want to be proud of the type any one of us chooses to be. So this is all by way of introduction, then we'll jump right into some page-based ideas. I am going to be focusing exclusively on this conversation on Orthodox, Conservative, and Reform versions of Judaism, which is not to erase the presence and gift of renewal and Reconstructionism. It is not to even try to address humanist Judaism, which is ultimately a Judaism that doesn't believe in God. I would advocate, by the way, as a one-word response to that question, that a Judaism that doesn't believe in God is likely just as theistic as the Judaisms that do believe in God, because the God that is rejected by humanist Judaism is likely rejected by most versions of Judaism too. We'll get to that maybe. Maybe not today. In terms of renewal, one of the reasons I don't want to get to it is because it is ultimately part and parcel of modern ecstatic versions of Judaism, not limited to renewal. Another way of saying that is renewal Judaism is a modern incarnation of Hasidic Judaism, which says that the form is important, but the emotionality is just as important. I think we say that too. If we don't say that, we should. And the gift of renewal Judaism, founded by many people, including Rabbi Zalman Schachter Shalomi, is that you've got to be Jewish with feeling. That's the name of one of his latest books. So we should assume that, postulate it as a pervasive truth for modern relevant Judaism. The reason why I'm not going to be talking about Reconstructionist Judaism is similar. Reconstructionism was founded by a conservative rabbi who used to be an Orthodox rabbi who then couldn't figure out what kind of a person he wanted to be in the world. His name was Rabbi Mordechai Menachem Kaplan, and he changed everything. He founded the modern Orthodox synagogue body, National Council of Young Israel. He was a rabbi of an Orthodox shul in New York called the Jewish Center. He was the founder of the Undergrad Teachers Institute at JTS, the conservative movement's university in New York. He then founded the Jewish Community Center movement, suggesting that shuls needed to have pools to get the Jews. And he was right about everything that he taught, including the fact that he had to be honest about what he believed in order to teach anything authentically. So I know I'm throwing a lot out, but what's important to me as a starting point is that there are an infinite variety of Judaisms out there. There are what Rabbi Gershon Cohen, who was the chancellor of the seminary when it decided to ordain women, what he called the varieties of Judaism. There are a lot of wonderful versions of Judaism out there. We can't talk about all of them. And the reason why I would choose to talk about Orthodox, Conservative, and Reform is because they reach the most people. Because one of my central arguments is going to be that denominations are utilitarian. That denominations are useful because they bring people together in large numbers. So we'll talk about that too. I have an article that's coming out. I made 20 copies, which is not going to be adequate. But if you email me because you didn't get a copy, I'll try to send it to you via email. It's not for distribution. It's coming out in a journal by the Academy of Jewish Religion in New York, which is not the same as the one in L.A. Their journal is called Gvanim, which means varieties. And it's I called it denominationalist Judaism ? Okay. It's over there. It's lavender, I think. So let's get started. What I'm about to do is unfair, and we're going to do it anyway. All three of the movements that I'm planning on discussing, please. And actually, Ron, can I ask you to distribute that one too? I have 40 copies, so best guess. If you need to share, please enjoy each other. Every one of the movements we're going to be discussing has changed over time. In fact, that's part of the interesting thing. Even Orthodoxy is not the same as it once was. Reform is not the same as it once was. Conservative never figured out what it was, and so it can't be the same. And what we have in front of us is an opportunity to look at snapshots. Those snapshots are really important. Here's what we're not going to do also. We are not going to talk about the worldwide phenomenon of any one of the movements. Orthodoxy in America is different than Orthodoxy in Israel. Conservative Judaism in America is different than Masorti Judaism in Israel or England or France or South America or the former Soviet Union. Reform Judaism is different. It's progressive Judaism elsewhere, but there's Neo-Orthodoxy in Budapest, which is sort of conservative Judaism. There's traditional, you name it. The variety is different anywhere but America, and even within America, the shifts have been enormous. We are going to look at, historically, which one came first in that order, but we're only looking at one moment of its history. The order is going to be Reform, Conservative, Orthodox, because as movements exist, that's sort of the way they developed. Orthodox rabbis and Jews would probably say, we aren't a movement, so you can't identify us like that. We don't have a unifying body. But that also presumes that any other body actually is a movement. So the conservative movement is likely better defined as a confederation of synagogues, which was originally founded as a placement service for JTS, a rabbinical school. Everything has changed. We'll get to that in a second, too. I'll say more about that when we do conservative Judaism. And Orthodoxy describes itself as a continuation of authentic Judaism with as little intervention as is possible. Here's a paradigm that I like to use with a snapshot as to what each ideology might teach of itself. It was developed by Rabbi Dr. Aryeh Cohen, who's a professor of rabbinics at the Ziegler School in L.A. It's the conservative movement's rabbinical school in Los Angeles, part of American Jewish University. He's a tremendous social activist and a wonderful, wonderful person. He has suggested a three-part paradigm that I've used in some of my advocacy and teaching. It is based on biblical text. When we have a troubling tradition that we inherit, what is our power to make a difference in that situation? So he suggests that the three paradigms are Aaron, Abraham, and Moses, based on specific encounters with troubling biblical text, troubling stories in the Torah. Aaron witnesses the death of his two sons, Nadab and Abihu, who bring gifts, strange fire, as the Indigo Girls have adopted the term, strange fire that wasn't invited, and they are consumed before God by a fire. We don't know what that text means, but just for the moment, let's assume that Aaron was in pain. His response is one of Aryeh Cohen's first paradigmatic responses. The Hebrew is Vayidom Aharon. Aaron was silent. In the face of a religious experience that he could not comprehend and made no sense, his place was not to respond. So that's one response. Troubling tradition, my place is I don't have authority. I accept the trouble, and I am ultimately either powerless or choose to be powerless. Another response is Abraham. When God says in the book of Bereshit, of Genesis, how can I do this without telling my beloved friend Avraham what my plan is with Sodom and Gomorrah, Sodom and Gomorrah? God tells Avraham what the plan is, and Avraham's response to God is two words also. Actually, more than that. Chalila lach, hashofet kol haaretz lo yaseh mishpat. Shame on you, God. Should the judge of all the earth not act justly? So the response that Aryeh Cohen points to in Abraham is one of masal matan, give and take, tension, struggle, haggle. I don't accept this tradition, but I'm not walking away from it. This is not God in the world. I refuse to accept it. A third paradigm is that of Moses. It's a violent response. When Moses, after the golden calf, protests in his people's defense, in our people's defense, before God who wants to wipe them out, right? God says, move out of my way, Moses. I'm going to destroy them. Moses says, no. And again, two words more. Mecheina mesifrecha. Erase me out of your book if you do such a thing, which is violent. I am going to rip you out. Or I'm going to rip myself out. This is not holy, and therefore it cannot be. I cannot coexist with you and with the text. So those three are not fair, but they are stereotypic. And for the purpose of our conversation, I'll use them. No one from within their relationship with God or their denomination would see themselves as anti-religious, anti-Jewish, anti-God. But within this three-part response, I have no power to change tradition could be stereotypically applied as an Orthodox response to troubling tradition. Not the same as modern Orthodoxy, which explicitly struggles. I have a relationship with God and the troubling tradition demands a response and I do have power and won't walk away could be seen stereotypically as a conservative Jewish position where the flexibility is part, the struggle is part, God and I must be part, and what we figure out as a potential response is a huge part. It defines, I think, conservative Judaism. The response of Moshe saying, this troubling tradition has no reconciliation. I can't synthesize it. It doesn't work. This is not Torah. I don't physically rip it out of the scroll of Torah, but I refuse to deal with that. By dealing with this, I can't assimilate it. It doesn't work. The laws in Leviticus about homosexuality as an abomination, male anal sex as an abomination, I want to be more specific. That's not God. I walk away from it. In fact, by the way, Aryeh Cohen in this article points to something that isn't biblical text, but is midrashic, is a later expansion on the text, and points to it asking in Reish Lakish, who's an ancient rabbi's voice, could a holy tongue say this? And the holy tongue is depicting God as an abusive husband. It's a Shemot Rabbah. It's an ancient midrash where our people's sufferings over and over are brought into question with a parable. The parable is a husband who beats his wife, and the wife's best friends say to the husband, well, if you don't love her, kill her. But don't hurt her like this. And the husband says, oh, I'd never kill her. So Reish Lakish says, could a holy tongue say this? And Aryeh Cohen's response ultimately to teaching this text, because remember he's a professor of rabbinics who taught this in class, is that is not Torah. I cannot deal with this. I rip it out of the canon of sacred literature. That is a very robust, muscular, and I would say moral response to an immoral portion of tradition. Aryeh Cohen struggles with this. We must struggle with this. But there's a certain point at which there is a line that is brought. And if we accept inherited tradition in all of its forms, we have to acknowledge that we are powerful. And I would postulate we are powerful. Even those who join Orthodox shuls or are Orthodox rabbis are acting with a muscular intention to preserve tradition as inherited. That is ultimately a choice, which is why I think that Reconstructionism is actually all of Judaism. The choice to maintain the system as a community, which is the definition of Reconstructionism, either maintaining, shifting, redeciding, reconstructing Judaism, that is the pervasive reality of Judaism. Because even if I'm defending it as it is, preserving the status quo, I'm acting. My choice to not change is a choice. Now we, as one of those strange shuls that uses the word conservative at least recently out loud, we got to figure out where we are. What do we do? And does it matter to be connected with a denomination ultimately? So let's jump into the text a little bit, and I hope to give enough time for a short conversation once we're done. Starting with Reform Judaism, it's on the blue sheets. This is the original formulation of Reform Judaism in America, in North America. This is the Pittsburgh platform. It's from 1885. Remember the context of the world. Right? I mean, to take the time amidst civil war, post-civil war, during civil war, these ideas were really, everything's unsettled. It sounds eerily familiar sometimes, that everything is unsettled until we take time to have a conversation about Judaism, like today. So this is the first formulation of Reform Judaism. Paragraph by paragraph, here's what they talk about as topics, if you want a one-word blurb. God is paragraph one. Torah is item two. Halakha, Jewish law and tradition, is three and four. Mashiach and the State of Israel is paragraph five. Even though they couldn't have spoken about the State of Israel, except that Herzl was right then. And so was Martin Buber, by the way. Six is about pluralism, meaning beyond the boundaries of Judaism. Seven is about the world to come and resurrection. Eight is social justice. They took on a lot. They were trying to say, this is Judaism. Look at some of the most, and I'll just select blurbs from within each paragraph. We're not going to analyze the whole page. The third line of item one, Judaism presents the highest conception of the God idea as taught in our holy scriptures and developed. This God idea, at the end of the paragraph, is the central religious truth for the human race. That's very interesting, isn't it? We've got it. Let's see how it's countered in the paragraph about pluralism, which is paragraph six. We recognize in Judaism a progressive religion, ever striving to be in accord with the postulates of reason. So rationalism is a goal of Judaism. If we can make sense of it, it belongs. Right? Christianity and Islam are daughter religions of Judaism. We appreciate their providential mission to aid in the spreading of monotheistic and moral truth. We extend a hand of fellowship. So other religions bear truth. Only monotheistic religions qualify here. So Hinduism would be an interesting place to work. Secular or atheistic, whatever we would call it. Humanist. Interesting. Where do they fit? But they're rationalists, so if they're rationalists, maybe. Hinduism's still out. Buddhism, it's not exactly a religion, so what do we do with it? I don't know what he would say, what they would say. That was sections 1 and 6. Paragraph 2, Torah. What is Torah? The Bible is the record of the consecration of the Jewish people to its mission as the priest of one God. We hold that the modern discoveries of scientific researches in the domain of nature and history are not antagonistic to the doctrines of Judaism, which means human beings wrote the Torah, and that's okay by us. Halakha and tradition is 3 and 4. We maintain only such ceremonies as elevate and sanctify our lives, but reject as such all such as are not adapted to the views and habits of modern civilization. So let's talk about kashrut. Look at the very next paragraph. We hold that all such Mosaic, mean biblical, and rabbinical laws as regulate diet, priestly purity, and dress originated in ages and under the influence of ideas entirely foreign to our present mental and spiritual state. They fail to impress the modern Jew with the spirit of priestly holiness. Their observance in our days is apt rather to obstruct rather than to further modern spiritual elevation. Some of us feel that in our daily lives, that as a community, one of the questions might be, what do we aspire to as a community? Do we reject categories of Jewish tradition because they aren't speaking to us, or must we adapt them? I'm already advocating for my personal passion, but I want to make sure that we allow Reform Judaism in its inception, modern American Reform Judaism, to speak in its own voice. So, jury, please strike from the record what Rabbi Kreditzer just said. That's halakha. Halakha is determined, well, the word halakha doesn't exactly happen here. Jewish law is only valid if it elevates us by our subjective experience. That was 3 and 4. 5. Let me just read it. We recognize in the modern era of universal culture of heart and intellect, right, these are such catchphrases during those times, The approaching of the realization of Israel's great messianic hope, not Messiah, messianic hope, for the establishment of the kingdom of truth, justice, and peace among all men. We consider ourselves no longer a nation. That is a huge sentence. But a religious community, what Kaplan would later call a civilization. And therefore expect neither a return to Palestine, there is going to be no modern state of Israel. Interesting, because ultimately Reform Judaism was the first to establish a rabbinical seminary in Jerusalem. Nor a sacrificial worship under the sons of Aaron. So we are the priests, but that doesn't mean what it used to mean. We are the new priests. Pretty rebellious and claiming the same title. I kind of like that, actually. Nor the restoration of any of the laws concerning the Jewish state. We are not going to assert ourselves in the international forum with what they would likely have said was a corrupt religious political vision. That's not what we aspire to. Rational peace between all men, all peoples. Doesn't have space for a particular like a Jewish state. Our modern struggle with both being good and having a homeland is exactly what they thought would happen. So I'm not saying they're right, but I'm not saying they're wrong either. The world to come in resurrection, that's in section 7. We reassert the doctrine of Judaism that the soul is immortal. Interesting, what's that doctrine of Judaism? That really doesn't actually have a basis in biblical or early rabbinic texts, because early rabbinic texts really had a dualist approach to what the soul was in the body. The body returns to earth, the soul is immortal. But is that true? No, because resurrection is me resurrected in my body. So the unity of both is actually part of the argument. This is a long debate. I'm just saying that they are saying what they believe, and it's not the only way of looking at tradition before them. We reject as ideas not rooted in Judaism the beliefs both in bodily resurrection. Okay, that's interesting. They didn't believe that. Ezekiel did. Although it wasn't personal resurrection, it was natural resurrection. There's a Neil Gilman's book, The Death of Death, is the right place to look for an argument. If not the truth, but an argument about this. And Gehenna and Eden, hell and paradise, is abodes for everlasting punishment and reward. What they are saying is that we live and then we die, and our soul lives forever, and that's what it is. Right? So the second blessing of the Amidah, Mechayei HaMetim, God who resurrects the dead, which can be translated multiple ways, was replaced. Mechayei HaKol, gives life to all. Right? We'll talk
about that.
But brought back.
In the most recent.
Oh yeah, of course. I'm sorry. The Mishkan Tefillah, the new Reform Jewish Sidur, brings back Mechayei Metim. That's one of the reasons I made sure to say the dates.
Yes.
It's fascinating to see what Reform Judaism has become, what it's becoming, whether or not that's real, which pockets of American Judaism in the Reform context it's happening. A vignette is that my colleague in Sharon, Massachusetts, where I used to be a rabbi, Rabbi Joseph Metzler, who's a phenomenal teacher, and I were talking about a new book that came out in the Reform Jewish Press, the URJ. Striving for holiness or something holiness. I said, oh my God, this speaks to me so incredibly. I am moved. He said, yeah, he doesn't really get it. Because ultimately, the question of what Judaism must be in the living community has to be based on what the community expects, where they are, what an aspirational journey could be like, given real starting points. But this is not really about today. This is about then. So if the Reform Jewish Statement of Principles, which we're holding in front of us, is based on one historical moment of the Reform Jewish community's life, it tells us about them then, but can't, by its own definition, control modern Reform Judaism. Right? It's a starting point, similar to what they said the Torah was.
Why by its own definition?
By its own definition, this is an assertion of the moment, and when they say, in statement 3, they reject all such laws or systems as are not adapted to the views and habits of modern civilization. They open themselves up, I think, to the question of what modern civilization will say is meaningful. I agree. I think they were being very fundamentalist in their statements, but I would say that by their own standards, they can't be held as more Torah than Torah. They might not like that I said that, but modern Reform rabbis have acted that way. So the reality of it is probably as subversive as I hope to be. Other sentence, don't quote me. Paragraph 8, and then we'll move on just a little bit after we do a little bit of give and take. Paragraph 8 is about social justice, which became the rallying call of Reform Judaism. It is, in fact, one of the biggest gifts that Reform Judaism has brought to all parts of Judaism. The conservative movement only recently got on board that social justice was a religious imperative on the national scale. Orthodox Judaism got it a little bit sooner, but Reform Judaism is where that impulse began, because they don't invoke the prophets. But what they are saying, ultimately, is that the prophetic yearning for a universal good. We read on Yom Kippur a section of the prophets which says, you're fasting, but you're sinning. That's a fast? That's what I'm asking for? Reform Judaism affirmed that prophetic voice at the expense of Mosaic law. As opposed to saying Moses brought law, Jesus brought grace. They said Moses brought law, the prophets were the natural successors to Mosaic rule, and questioned the truth, the usefulness, the holiness of the law if you aren't being good while standing in that world. We actually say that in our morning tefillot, anyone who gets here early enough. One of the sections of rabbinic teaching that we read together, usually in English, is what does it mean to follow God? Be good. And don't feel at a loss when sacrifice has been abandoned or been lost to us, because we have replacements for that. Tzedakah, which is not charity, that's caritas in a Catholic language, that's love. Tzedakah is justice. We don't give because it feels good. We give because we have to, or the world fails. So in fact, the early concept of Reform Judaism is quite rabbinic, but is more prophetic than either rabbinic or Mosaic. It takes a prophetic chunk to be good in the world in a rational way based on what we see and who we are, and push it forward. Okay, that's a lot to start with. If I did it right, that was Reform Judaism in 14 minutes. And good luck to me. Anyone who's listening and wants to email me, rabbicreditor@gmail.com, tell me what I got wrong. Rob.
So, you spoke about this in my talk book. I was thinking of something. The example of that. When you gave your open about, you know, small club, the voters of small club, and what they did, and finding the human rights and egalitarianism and all that, I have something templating in my brain, the amount of clips that it took with that. Their job to do that. And I sort of plug that in here with the originators of Reform Judaism. It probably took several generations to get the inertial processes to stand up in orthodoxy. There's some component in there that's worthy of touching on. You were just saying.
Yeah. Holy chutzpah is what Rabbi Orr Rose, in a new collection, he spoke here right when the book came out, called Righteous Indignation. It presumes a number of things. One is that I have a place in a holy conversation. I, as a modern, subjective, moral, religious, whatever that means, Jew, am powerful. I am not subject to inherited tradition in a way that would contravene the Torah's phrase, v'chai b'hem, live with them. And so I would say that, yes, Reform Judaism, and any Judaism that opens up its mouth differently from the paradigm of Aaron, Vayidom, being silent in the face of troubling tradition, any one of those is acting in the tradition of Benot Slavchad. I would go even further back. I would say that Rivka, as manipulating the system to make sure that her son Yaakov would end up inheriting tradition, she manipulates the system in a way that presumably God wants, at least according to the Torah's version of it. We, when we open up our voices, are pretty chutzpahdik. The question is that unwelcome? And I would say, from my standpoint, no. Reform Judaism clearly was standing up to its contemporary, they would say stifled versions of Judaism. Stagnant. You know, where's your voice, they would say. And this is who we are. It did take some time. In the European version of the emergence of Reform Judaism, the original breaking point when progressive rabbis got together, the reason that some broke off and created earlier conservative Judaism, with Zacharia Frankel taking the lead in Frankfurt and Breslau, is that they wanted to give the sermon in German. Why? Because I'm here and I want to understand, and don't demand of me that I just sit and witness, and I want to engage. Even if it's very frontal, which was the presentation style, even in the vernacular, give me a place at the table. That's pretty chutzpahdik. just for a moment, let's take it out of that denominational question and say we're sitting at the table. It's the Thanksgiving dinner for our families, wherever we really do them. And the six-year-old at the table gets up and says, don't bring out the turkey yet. I want to know why we're doing this. Well, that's a seder, by the way. But that's chutzpahdik. And the question is, how do those in power, the grown-ups at the table, allow that six-year-old to speak truth? Counsel. Okay, guidance. Okay, but rejection of the question? That was what was happening, at least by and large, in non-denominational Judaism, because either people were walking away from it, or they were accepting it. But where was the place for the chutzpahniks? So let's hold on to that. Thank you for the question. Karen?
I think that it's, we can't understand any denomination, but particularly this platform, without looking at the social conditions of the time. Not to in any way minimize this as a philosophical, true, absolute statement, but I think also influenced by Jews wanting to fit in,
good,
and seem more American and not have too many weird old customs like not eating pig and so forth. And
right.
You know, it's fun, you probably read this stuff too, of what like the decorum was like. You know, very into decorum, and
right.
You could find, the rabbi, by the way, could find a congregant who didn't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did we get to collect? We could collect the fine ourselves?
I don't know about that.
Okay.
But I think that we have to look at that. So that right. It's a different question today, that it's always
well
part of social conditions. And I think also as part of that, looking at, I appreciate what you said, I'm both in the Reconstructionist and Renewal movements, looking at, as well as conservative, almost every movement except New York, looking at that again, I always, and this is something I learned in Reconstructionist rabbinical school, always looking at the social conditions of the time, I appreciate you don't want to go into detail about Recon or Renewal, and you properly, you know, say how they've influenced all the movements, but just a question I would put out is the fact that Renewal is not a formal denomination, and Reconstructionist is the smallest of the four, means that the ideas are not, has some influence on how the ideas get out there. Like, you can't totally separate the fact that they're not strong institutions from the ideas. For example, Reconstructionism doesn't have written responsa, which are rabbinic answers to philosophic questions. We always look at the Reform has books of philosophy, has book of responsa.
Right.
And Recon adds such a thing, its influence of the ideas, you know, might be greater. So all those sort of, like, what kind of institutions we can get together and, you know, what the financial support is for those institutions influence the ideas.
Yeah, let me just speak loudest the thing that was pervasive in what you just said, and I appreciate it very much, which is that the social context has everything to do with the language and the ideas. In fact, if you take the Bibles that we've used in the Jewish world, not just conservative, both from the time of this platform, which is when the same year, actually 2 years before, Rabbi Joseph Hertz was ordained as the first graduate of JTS and became the chief rabbi of England. The Hertz Chumash that many of us experienced both was the first time that biblical criticism was allowed into a Torah commentary used in synagogues, but was also an apologetic trying to prove to the non-Jewish world that we weren't weird. We weren't primitive. We are civilized. This is how we process. And I think we have come to a place in the modern world where we sort of embrace our weirdness. We talk about how strange it is to hold a lulav and live in a hut. We talk about kashrut as something that elevates our mindfulness. The particular is part of the universal, which is actually, by the way, a central argument in the article that's over there. So I also want to agree with you that the institutional support and what that means in the context has everything to do with the loudness of the voice. I would say, however, that Reconstructionism has much in common with conservative Judaism, both because of the birthplace being so common, but also because, maybe Renewal too, but I don't know enough, because the size of the institutions actually has very little to do with what the ideas have done. Right? It has been said about conservative Judaism that we are a laboratory that never brands our product. Right? We are successful because everything has changed. Reconstructionism is a product. The Chavurah movement is a product. Transdenominational work and learning is actually a product of the conservative movement. You look at everyone who's leading those efforts, and many of them, I haven't done a study, but I did a quick thing for this article, many of them are being led by, quote, products of the conservative movement. Art Green, who was ordained at JTS, was the dean at Hebrew College's rabbinical school, and is a leader in the neo-Hasidic renewal-ish Reconstructionist, because he was the president of the Reconstructionist Rabbinical College movement. Eli Kanfer, who created this new thing called Michon Hadar, the first American full-time egalitarian yeshiva in New York, won't call it conservative, but A, is a child of a conservative rabbi, and was just ordained at the seminary. The Academy for Jewish Religion in New York is headed by David Greenstein, who is a project of JTS, Ora Horn Prouser, who's a professor at JTS, and just ordained Judith Hauptman, who's been a loud teacher in the conservative movement. So that's all these different permutations are strangely related. And I think that Renewal's voice is very clearly pervasive, and the struggle within Renewal, as I understand it, to have a cohesive structure is very interesting, because it's the birth of a movement-ish. I don't know that anyone should wish for a movement, but it does give you an ability to have your platform recognized. So if the question is branding, all right, so some get it better, some get it worse. But if the question is the idea of becoming pervasive, I actually think that's harder to measure and more exciting. All right, so one last one, then we'll just move on. Michael. Thank you, Ken.
Kind of continuing with her, I thousands of years ago, when you talk in the Torah, trying to separate Judaism out from the other religions and nationalities around.
Good.
And this seems to be the same thing. They want to assimilate. They make sure they say, we don't believe in my resurrection. We don't believe in heaven. Then it's like you're defending yourself to the Orthodox and the other world at the same time.
Right.
We're moving more, you know, we're assimilating, but we're still not them.
Right.
And it seems they're still defensive.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very hard to be who we are and confident in the world. That's a Jewish problem. I think Woody Allen is the best example of that. But I also think that you're right, that there is a tradition of defensiveness. Josh Kornbluth and I have been talking about that a lot recently. The question of, for those who don't know, he's a wonderful monologist and a new member of Nativot Shalom, actually. And he just joined the Nativot Facebook. So. So we are going to use something that he said to jump back in, which is, he asked me a question as part of his preparation for the Andy Warhol monologue that he did recently. He said, what would you do, what would you do if suddenly you were accepted? And I freaked out. Because I don't know what I'd do. The marginalization of the Jew is what birthed the Talmud. The whole process of marginalization, you see on the page, there's a core, there's one generation, there's another, and we all disagree, and we all have one page, and being marginal is what brings us together. Not because we are held in disgust by the outside world, though that is all too true sometimes, but the defensiveness is honest. We are a radical minority. We are very scared of losing our, quote, power. And anytime someone from the outside points to our power, we get scared. So it's not a plan to dominate the world as the Zionist protocols, you know, yuck. But we're scared. There's some great, I don't know, you know the joke? You know, so there are two prisoners of war. I think maybe I told it in an earlier one, but there are two prisoners of war, Jewish prisoners of war, in a work camp. And one of them is, you know, their lives are awful, and one of them is crying, and the other one, he sees, is laughing. He said, why are you laughing? And he says, well, I'll tell you, you know, I thought we had it really bad. I mean, we're in Siberia. It's like, this is awful. But then the officer, the warden watching us, who is screaming at me, said, you Jews, you control the media, you control the banks, you control the world. And suddenly I realized, that's great, we're doing all right. And so the question of being the perpetual outsider, what Kornbluth pointed to as being a mercurial people, based on a book called The Jewish Century, we are mercurial. You can't touch us because we're always in flux, always in motion. In fact, I think that's the ethos of the Jew. Even though we are accepted in many ways in North America, there's no question that there are plenty of experiences where a swastika is painted. There are plenty of experiences that tinge from anti-Zionism to anti-Semitism. There are plenty of moments where we are uncomfortable as Jews in the world. So the defensiveness of the early Reform movement, I think, is also authentic. Just like it was in the Torah, though, the Reform movement isn't saying, God told me to feel this way and act on it. So I think that's an important tension to keep alive. Last one, Barbara, we've got to move forward.
This isn't a question. I just wanted to clarify. You started talking about three types.
Yeah.
And you said, Barry might be seen as orthodox. And you might take Abraham on surgery.
Thank you. No, if I didn't say it, what I was, and it's only stereotypic, it's actually case by case, not always true, but that the willingness to reject inherited tradition and use the word reject is a reform, not staple, but is in the toolbox.
I just have to say, Abraham sometimes stayed, in other words, with his son.
Right.
Right.
Kierkegaard calls Abraham's willingness to sacrifice his own son the theological suspension. That Abraham is willing to suspend what he thinks is good in order to do what God tells him to do. I chose a Sodom and Gomorrah story because Arya Cohen did, and it's easier to point to. But Yoni, your point is well taken. Let's move on just a little bit. Try to be sensitive to time. Let's talk quickly, as if that wasn't already very quickly, about orthodoxy. And then we'll see if we have a moment or two to talk about conservative Judaism. Orthodoxy is on the other side of the blue sheet. This is from a collection by the American Jewish Congress in 1965 called The Condition of Jewish Belief. It is the text that I hated when I first encountered it, and now I have earmarked copies, multiple copies. Rabbi Neil Gilman, who's going to be our scholar in residence on Memorial Day at our retreat, made me read the book. And in fact, before I knew I could buy it, I borrowed his and copied his entire book. I don't know where that is, but it's such a treasure, if I can find it. It collected from the various movements of Judaism responses to specific questions by leaders. So this is an excerpt of Rabbi Norman Lamb, who was then, and until very recently, the chancellor of Yeshiva University, a spokesperson for orthodoxy. It's very interesting to use the word modern with relation to orthodox, so let's not for now. And paragraph by paragraph, here are the bullet points that at least I've scribbled for myself. The first paragraph is about revelation. The second paragraph is about divine inspiration. The third is about the literary critical approach to Torah not being the creation of God. The next one is about Jewish learning. And the last one is suggests, and this, I'll just say this out loud as a paraphrase, that rational law is not determined by what human beings can figure out. That even the laws that we can't figure out have a reason, it's just not within our reach. In his first paragraph, all the emphasis here is mine. I edited pretty subjectively. God's will was communicated in discrete words and letters at Sinai. The divine will, if it is to be made known, is sufficiently important for it to be revealed in as direct, unequivocal, and unambiguous a manner as possible, so that it will be understood by the largest number of people to whom this will be addressed. Language, though so faulty an instrument, is still the best means of communication to most human beings. And so what he's saying is, since that's how we understand anything, God chose that. God did that. What we hold as Torah, and I'm holding it like a book, but it's really a scroll, which wasn't originally a scroll, it was here. What we hold is God's words. Second one, I'm not going to read it. Divine inspiration is not an adequate way of describing revelation. Divine inspiration means I am the emulsifier of the divine, and therefore I have ultimately either a corrupting influence or an inadequate role vis-a-vis communicating God. I can be a channel, but no one's that clear. Third paragraph. Literary criticism is a problem, but not a crucial one. We've dealt with worse problems before. Since I assert, says Lamb, that the Torah we have is God's word, literary criticism? All right, that's just a challenge. We'll get past it. Next paragraph is that Jewish learning based on the word Torah, which means instruction, Hora'ah, that's the supreme value. And that's why Torah is so holy. And Torah's holiness doesn't mean five books holiness. Torah, as a written incarnation of God's divine will, is our learning, is our soul, is our core. His last sentence is actually quite beautiful. For the same reason, last sentence in the second to last paragraph. For the same reason, Torah is not only legislation, halakha, but in its broadest meaning, Torah teaching a term that includes the full spectrum of spiritual edification, theological and ethical, mystical and rhapsodic. That's beautiful. I am not on the attack. What I am not out to do, either to reform or Orthodox Judaism, is delegitimize it. I know I've said that already. But when I talk, I try, when I make this kind of a presentation, it is my ultimate goal to affirm the ideas from within and then to respond to them as an individual. But Lamb's language here is incredibly compelling. The last one, rationalism is more than our ability. So the bold sentence that I have there, given the above, it is clear that I regard all of the Torah as binding on the Jew. So let's just point to the beginning and the end of his, of the excerpt of his words. The beginning is, this is God's word, what you hold in your hands. That, by the way, the end of the second paragraph, to deny that God can make his will clearly known is to impose upon him a limitation of dumbness that would insult the least of his human creatures. That's also quite compelling. I reject it, but I'm very moved by his phrasing. So he starts with revelation. What happened at Sinai happened. We have the record, not of the encounter, but of the divine will. Concrete. I know what God expects of me. Therefore, his last paragraph. Therefore, I must do it. And my rational faculties are not powerful enough. I have no place to challenge God's will. I am subservient to God's will. As spiritual edification continues, and that is a wonderfully ambiguous sentence, phrase. As the edification continues, maybe implicitly change would happen. But I cannot say, this must change. Why can't I say this must change? Because God said this. So that was not fair to Orthodoxy, but that's Orthodoxy in 3 minutes. Right. Modern Orthodoxy, just for half a second, is a much more complicated version of that. Modern Orthodoxy is what I would consider conservative Judaism in a slightly different framework. Modern Orthodoxy is, we as a community yearn for sacred values like egalitarianism, and we are bound by God's will as we understand it. So how do we have a conversation with integrity, allowing change that doesn't disrupt God in our life? So men and women sit separately, but women can hold the Torah. Men and women sit separately, but women are our teachers. There are only male rabbis, but women teach Talmud. Those are things that did not exist in early Orthodoxy. There are struggles within, and rabbis who affirm that within the Orthodox world are typically marginalized by the Orthodox world. I have incredible admiration for those who stand in the breach. Rabbi Yonatan Cohen in our community is one of those heroes. And he has incredible integrity. We come together, Rabbi Cohen and I meet weekly when we can, and we share Torah, because there's a place at the table for all of us. And we can be ourselves in conversation. But what brings us together ultimately is our willingness to encounter the other as a legitimate teacher in Jewish tradition. Orthodoxy, not modern Orthodoxy. Orthodoxy does not affirm that. Orthodoxy does not affirm the legitimacy of multiple denominations. Orthodox rabbis are forbidden from participating in interdenominational rabbinic meetings. Orthodox rabbis, like Rabbi Haskell Lookstein in New York, who participated in the inauguration interfaith ceremony, he was called a traitor by the Rabbinical Council of America, which is the largest group of Orthodox rabbis in America. Why? Because they have a rule that Orthodox rabbis are not allowed to participate in interfaith religious ceremonies. Even though the language was entirely ecumenical, entirely pluralist, his legitimacy, and he is one of the leaders of Orthodox Judaism. He founded the school Ramaz. He's a rabbi of Kibbutz Jeshurun in New York. These are two powerhouses. His work has led to incredible vibrancy in Orthodoxy, let alone modern Orthodoxy. He was called into question because he pushed a boundary. So Orthodoxy not only delegitimizes, and I'm not saying with evil intent, it is a sacred imperative for an Orthodox rabbi to say, I have God's word. I won't hate you, but I can't recognize this as authentic Judaism, where you're teaching. So modern Orthodox rabbis suffer the same way, and therefore sometimes they don't publish because they're scared of being called out. So I want to make sure that we understand that every stance takes incredible bravery, chutzpah. Even orthodoxy does. So I'm not trying to castigate their principles. I don't accept them. But that doesn't mean they don't have a place in the conversation. Okay, that's a lot. And that's orthodoxy now in 6 minutes. Ellen.
Reveals a direct, unequivocal, unambiguous manner, so it will be understood by the largest number of people. That suggests to me that, in a way, orthodoxy, you know, one could say it could be rote, whereas Reform Judaism or conservative or other approaches require the individual to bring some of his or her own thought processes to it.
I do. I don't think that's what Lamb is saying. Just in case people didn't hear, Ellen was suggesting that Lamb's sentence about the most people understanding, this being a utilitarian vehicle for communication, would suggest that orthodoxy could be rote, whereas non-orthodoxy, for lack of a better phrase, couldn't be. In fact, I think that's both in reality and in theory not the case. In our community, we are particularly reflective shul, and yet things can become rote quite quickly. I think everyone can set into a rut once a pattern of behavior is established. Even mindful practice can become mechanical. And I think orthodoxy, especially according to a second to last paragraph on the page, demands engagement, demands rhapsodic learning. Because if I am commanded to accept as binding a system that I can't understand, which is what he's saying, I've got to be able to do intellectual gymnastics, what became known in some circles as the Brisker methodology of learning. Well, I don't get it, but let's figure out a way to synthesize the idea. I'll end up doing the thing the way I was told, but I need to work at it. So I actually think that what he's demanding here is a more rigorous approach to Judaism than the non-Orthodox movements typically advocate, because you need to be bound and thoughtful. If we're going to learn, we should learn almost exactly the opposite, which is to say, we are thoughtful. Are we bound? Do we act as if we're bound? That's what I was trying to advocate in the first presentation in Dynamic Judaism, which is to say, we are very good at asserting the sovereign self in our world. How does Kashrut command us? How many of us make sure to go to shul not only because it's so glorious to be a community, but because we are commanded to stand at attention, to sit in mindfulness, to daven with words, without words? Where's the command in our daily life? Those things are incredibly important. I think orthodoxy has the advantage there. Because it commands action and the thought, I have a hard time, just personally, acting without reflecting. So there's metacognition. So that might be a modern gift curse, but metacognition is more possible when we are bound by action than when we're bound by thought.
What was the metacognition,
meaning thinking about thinking.
Yeah. How does that fit into
this? Because I'm good at the thinking, but I could think so long. Bill Bryson wrote this in A Short History of Nearly Everything. He points to a philosopher who was so thoughtful that he got up in the morning and sat at the edge of his bed for 4 hours. I got a long email from Stephen recently. Right? So that's beautiful, but what does it lead me to do? Does it get me out of bed? Not only does it get me out of bed, now I'm going to be extreme, and I'm not talking about anybody here, right? Does it get me to cross the street and visit Pastor Mike at the Way and say, what good must we be doing in the world together? The thought doesn't make me do it. It's my engagement in the world, realizing that the homelessness around our shul is an issue that we as a religious community must address. It's the action that commands me. I have to be thoughtful within my action, but when I get up in the morning, which is the first command, by the way, of the Code of Jewish Law,
get up
like a lion, is the first sentence in the Code of Jewish Law, the Shulchan Aruch, by Yosef Karo in 1563. Kum ka'ari, that is unbelievable.
Like a lion.
Use your intuitive... Let me be charitable and not define what lion-like behavior would mean. But let's also suggest that a lazy lion is not what we're talking about. You can be reflective and muscular, but if you don't move your body, you're not a lion. And I think we have a better time being dovish as a concept, thinking, cooing, yearning, flying, than we do acting like a lion. And I think it's possible to do that within all permutations of Judaism. But that's ultimately one of the things I think should be compelling to us. Last comment on this one, Peter.
It seems that orthodoxy, as defined here, sets itself outside of time, which is a peculiar thing to do, since it's such a pervasive dimension.
Well said.
And the time in which Judaism originated was itself outside of time, not bound by time, and therefore anything that develops in the world as we see it after that is irrelevant.
Yes. In a word, yes. To those who didn't hear Peter, one of the things that Lamb's excerpt, and I just want to keep on saying it's an excerpt, one of the things that Lamb is suggesting is that Judaism is a system, and even the origin of Judaism within time, all are outside of time. They are eternal. I actually think that's a cogent case, given that the word that we use for God most frequently, though we never pronounce it, means eternity. So the question is, why, as if I could ask this, and Lamb already has a response to me, why did Judaism only start existing at a certain time? The answer is because it did. And because Abraham was the first person attuned to it, as it were. But Abraham became attuned to a universal truth that he already knew by Ruach HaKodesh, by Holy Spirit, by prophecy. He knew how to daven three times a day, even though there was no such thing as a tefillah. He knew that the sacrifices would be offered. He knew there would be the destruction of the temple. He knew that the Exodus would happen. He knew about the Holocaust. He knew about us. Because it's eternal. When in Midrashic literature, ancient biblical characters become advocates for the Jewish people's welfare, that is again a stretching and melding of time. In Kabbalistic thinking and mystical thinking, that's entirely present as well. Because I can tap, and this was last year's series, the whole question of mythic time. I don't exist in one moment of time. I might not know the future, but I'm doing my best to not be limited to only right now when I speak. So I think you're right. I think it's a great critique. But sacred chronology isn't linear. And Lamb points to that without saying it. I think you read it quite well. So the question is, are we advocating a timeless tradition as we speak, or are we looking to validate us right now? That is a very important question to ask. I want to keep the question alive.
Well, more pertinently, are we to tailor our practices and, by extension, our belief system to what's true in this time?
Good.
And that's what Reform Judaism, it seems to me, was all about.
It's also what conservative Judaism is all about. Said differently, people
responded to the time.
But Taylor and responsive, Peter's question is, and I'm going to sort of cut this part of it short so we can move forward in the few minutes that we have left, is our responsibility, or Reform's Judaism responsibility, anyone's responsibility to tailor, I would say now, but to adapt, to respond, to do healthy assimilation, as Gershon Cohen again said, is our responsibility to make it fit now. The question is, can making it fit be a sacred enterprise? Can making it fit be timeless? I think the answer is yes, but it requires much more than Lamb is willing to have us do. I'm moving forward, and we're only going to take a few minutes. Since we are a conservative shul, I have a feeling we'll live it more than we'll read it, but let's look down for a second on the orange page. These are the textual excerpts from the article that's over there on the table when we're done. This was just recently published. The first presentation we made this year was based on this article. I was really excited to see it in print, and I'm glad that Rabbi Neil Gilman invited me to write something. So this is all excerpts, though I didn't write the whole series of quotes here, from an article called The Revelation of an Embrace, A Vision of Conservative Judaism. I also want to acknowledge how unfair this is. Reform Judaism is 1885. Orthodoxy is 1965 and conservative Judaism is today. Text A. This is a quote of Rabbi Neil Gilman. He says, I want to know, I'm just going to paraphrase everything. I just want to know why there's a halakha. Don't tell me what the rule is. Tell me why there's a rule. There's no system that's always been. So Peter, to respond to you, your read of Lamb, which Gilman teaches all the time, he'd say, don't tell me what is, tell me why. Give me why. Moving very quickly. Text B is an article by a colleague named Rabbi David Fine. He's a few years ahead of me. He's a rabbi in New York at the moment. He was also a gift to me when I was an undergrad. That was when email lists became big, and I was incredibly fundamentalist at the time. I couldn't stand Gilman. I couldn't stand Rabbi David Fine, who wasn't yet a rabbi. He was just a year or two ahead of me in college. And I was flaming left and right on email anyone who would suggest, you know, God didn't write the Torah. And David was incredibly gracious to me. I've thanked him endlessly. And if David, you're listening, thank you again. This is a quote of his from a paper that he presented to the Committee of Jewish Law and Standards, the Supreme Court, as it were, in the conservative movement. It is a recent tshuva, a recent legal response from 2002, because there was no legal response that advocated egalitarianism until after the fact. His was one of the first accepted. It was practiced before it was code. So he says, this is beautiful, the halakha flows like a river and one cannot ignore the direction of the flow. Halakha meaning Jewish law. There may be a point where the river can choose where it will go, but once that decision is made, there is no going back. The centrists of 1973 could not but agree with the arguments that there was no reasonable way to argue that the halachic sources could be used to support women's inclusion in the minyan, said in English. In 1973, many arguments were being made for egalitarianism in conservative Judaism, women's ordination in particular, and you couldn't argue from within the system. Not honestly. However, Jewish law and practice developed so that it was indeed the law that women did not count in the minyan. However, they also believed that law can change. One cannot retroactively reroute a decision that was made upstream by the flow of the river. However, from where we stand, the river continues on its journey. It has not emptied into a lake, which means tradition is not stagnant. It has not collected in an unchangeable body. While we cannot change what has already been determined upstream, we can direct the river from where we stand and influence where it will flow from us. This is beautiful. It's an after-the-fact justification for holy egalitarianism, for sacred inclusion. It's principled. Because I don't just stand witnessing the river, I have power to direct the river. Someone else will direct it after me. And someone directed it before me, but I know what I'm doing, and that sets me apart largely from those who came before. We're not going to do text C and D, except to say that my teacher and a friend of our community, Rabbi Bradley Shavit Artson, has suggested in response to me over and over that a conservative Judaism that has a moral imperative and therefore sometimes says no to one permutation of tradition. So in English, egalitarianism is not a choice. Egalitarianism is a halakhic mandate. He said, we can only be a movement with people who think like us, how can we be a Judaism for the whole world? To which I respond to him, we are not meant to be a Judaism for the whole world. The world has many types of Judaism. But in order to be who we are supposed to be in the world, we have to be principled and sometimes make a choice that does not have an equally legitimate alternative. Text D is a proof text of mine in response to text C. We'll skip that. And as a vision of conservative Judaism, I use the text E and F. One is biblical, one is rabbinic. And if you walk into the sanctuary, you'll notice that the wings of the kruvim, the wings of the cherubs, that's what we're looking at. And what happens from the middle, says this text? Make one cherub at the end here and the other end there. Of one piece with a cover shall you make the cherubs at its two ends. Those kruvim were above the original tablets, Indiana Jones. The cherubs shall have their wings spread out above, shielding the cover. They shall face each other. The faces of the cherubs being turned toward the cover, there I will meet you above the cover, from between the two kruvim, at the top of the Ark of the Pact. When we spread those curtains, we are releasing the divine into the world. Because it's not the wings, and it's not the cherubs, and it's not even the law. It's the context of the whole from which God's voice emerges, from between everything, at the flux capacitor from Back to the Future, where everything is in motion. Right? Through that weird nexus, the divine emerges into the world, which means you better be ready to open the ark. Spread that curtain and stand still, because it's going to overwhelm us. But how else could we be in relationship with God unless we're overwhelmed? That's a biblical text. Here's the rabbinic comments on it, text F. Rabbi Ketina said, when the Israelites would ascend to the temple on the festival, both for Shavuot, Sukkot, Pesach, the priests would roll up the curtain and display for them the cherubs joined together in an embrace. Sexual embrace, by the way, is the point here. The priest would then tell them, behold God's love for you, similar to human love. It's about relationship. And what is God's relationship with us? How can we learn it? By being together as human beings. So here's my comment on the comment, text G. We're not going to exactly end, but we might make a pause until the next presentation in a second. At the core of conservative Judaism is the belief that in every generation, the legitimate structuring element of organized religion, in this case halakha, Jewish law, is the product of collective covenantal negotiations that have taken place since the birth of the Torah itself. Halakha is part of our language. Holiness is its partner. The conservative movement, in its relationship to halakha, much like the cherubs, must be identified and identifiable with the very material that birthed it, stretching both toward each other and toward the world beyond, using our wings to both protect the core of our tradition and the nexus of emerging holiness. But like the revelation brought about by the priest rolling back the curtain, we are shown that change does not take place in conservative Judaism just because it can. Change takes place because it is necessary, and the embrace of change is an act of sacred love. If we had before you an Orthodox rabbi, they would say something like this too. If a Reform rabbi was standing before you, they would say that too. A Renewal rabbi, a Reconstructionist rabbi, and these are just rabbis, teachers, thoughtful teachers, would advocate with passion and with heart for their variety of Judaism being an incredibly authentic path to the divine. And, please God, may they be right. That's not our challenge. Our challenge is how to do it right for us. In our time. So what I would suggest as a jumping off point for some later conversation is this. In our community, and I would suggest for the conservative movement at large, which is not the only place that matters, but the place nearest to my heart, we have to matter. And we have to be in relationship with God. And we have to make sure that as we push the boundaries, which we are bound to do because we exist in time and have power, and moral sensibilities, that we root ourselves in tradition so that what we end up creating is recognizable. Ultimately recognizable by the next generation as authentic Judaism. Rabbi Avi Weiss, who is a leading modern Orthodox rabbi, in the debate of who is a Jew, matrilineal, patrilineal observance, all sorts of that, he says, I don't care who your parents are, who is a Jew is determined by who your grandchildren are. God bless you. And we have an obligation, I think, not to limit our children or our grandchildren's choices, because we have no power over that, but to make sure that the Judaism that we tried to birth today, based on who we are today, is absolutely based in a relationship with who we've always been. No matter what that means, we have power in the conversation, and we have to show up to shul, and we have to think about kashrut, and we have to think about Shabbat. We have to believe in what we are so passionately that we would speak about it like this. We would use the word God even though it confuses us. We would use the word halakha even though it makes us uncomfortable sometimes. We would talk about varieties of Judaism that delegitimize us with incredible love. And we should make sure never to do the same to a variety that speaks differently than us, because if God is infinite, then our path to God, the conservative Jewish path to God, is not the only one that counts. It's not the only one that works. It's not the only one that God wants, whatever that means. So this sacred embrace question, it begins right here, right now, within time. And dynamic Judaism only works if it's Judaism. Dynamic is the adjective. Judaism is the noun. And we have an incredible demand upon us, because if we act in concert with at least the way I'm suggesting we would, we don't always have the choice to change it, but we also don't have the choice to walk away. that would be not holy. I think we could, can, will, must act on our principles. The world, especially right now, is in incredible need of that kind of conviction, and a non-judgmental, fervent Judaism is going to make a lot of good things happen. I think we can do it here too. Thank you.